Thank you for joining. Everyone should be blessed with a Gutke Ben Shtiyar, a really, really, really sweet, sweet year with a lot of big brachas and new beginnings for everyone, complete purification and elevation, and should be a transformative year, the next up-and-coming year, for everybody individually. Transformations for good, for the Yidden Bechlal, and for the entire world. May we merit. Everybody senses, everybody knows, everybody feels the underlying tension that there is within universal tension. And I think we can all sense that the Eibishter is telling us that we're very, 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 very close. And may this year, 5778, be the year. The only better option is that 5777 should be the year. But may we merit Mamish Bekarav Mamish to finally experience true joy, true happiness, true oneness with the coming of Mashiach. May it happen. We have, again, the honor and the privilege to have with us Rabbi Chase Taub. Moved me so much on this Shabbos. I've learned so much and gained so much. I'm sure everybody that participated. I want to thank all those who made the Shabbos and today's Yom Iyun possible, particularly today's Yom Iyun, the entire day, and last night's very unique and special Slichus was made possible by a grant from the J. Samuel Horowitz and Manya Horowitz Charitable Trust. I want to thank Frank Lee for his help and a very big Yashar Koyach and Hashem. It should be an Aliyas Neshama for them, and there should be a lot of bracha to you, Frank, and everything in both in the Gashmias and Ruchnias. A wonderful good year, Aksiva Chasima Tev and a good Kebench Tiar, which reminds me also that everyone, if you can ask everyone to please put your phones either on silent or off. I wouldn't suggest that. But on silent or maybe on vibrate. Thank you very much. Also, there have been others who have contributed to make the Shabbos and today special and possible. So I want to thank all of those. Most of them anonymous. So thank you. And thanks everybody for coming.
And Rabbi, thank you for welcoming me for the last Shabbos of the year, 5777, and the beautiful Shabbos we spent together, and Slichus, and the entire day today, the Yom Iyun, and now, I don't have anything after this, right? This is it? Okay. From here to the airport. Okay. So, let me see this. Yeah, all right. I can move around a little bit, as long as I don't walk off frame, right? Okay. This is live? Oh, no. It's okay. You know, I reminded him. All right. What's this? What to pray for? Rosh Hashanah? Okay. So I'll start like this. I was once invited to speak on a panel of clergy of world religions. And fortunately, they asked me to represent Judaism. You got it. Okay, good. No, it was a good thing they asked me to represent Judaism. Because before we walked out on stage, they put all the world religions in a hat and you had to pick out of a hat. Only everyone's taking me seriously. Nah, what? It was true. No, there was. Okay. It was a panel of world religions, of clergy. I was representing Judaism because I'm Jewish. And what happened? It was at a university where they had a comparative religion department. That's like comparative literature, but you don't compare like Shakespeare. You compare different scriptures of different religions. So the moderator of the event was a grad student of the comparative religion department, and he began the panel by asking the clergy to introduce themselves. So he says like this, "We'd like to go down the row and have all the members of our panel, all of our clergy members, introduce themselves. Please, just very, very briefly, your name, your religion, and very briefly, your religion's concept of God." So that's what they did, one by one. And everyone sort of tried to, on one foot, as it were, to give a definition or their religion's definition of God. So they came to me, and I was last. And which was a good thing I was last, as you will see from this story, because the story could not have happened if I had not been last. And I said, okay, my name is Chase Taub, I represent Judaism, and if you want an authentic Jewish answer to your question or to any question, the authentic Jewish answer to a question is not an answer, but it is another question. So I want to ask a question. But before I can even ask my question, I want to make an observation. My observation is this. I listened to all of the clergy members on this panel and their definition of God. And although they all said different things, there was one thing that I found to be the common denominator that everyone said. Everyone said that part of their definition of God is that God is a creator. Now, that's my observation, that everyone said God is a creator. So here's my question. Being that God is eternal and always existed and will always exist, or at least I'm assuming that's what everyone will agree, and that creation, by definition, by the word creation, means it was created. It has an origin. It didn't always exist. It had to be created. So it wasn't always here. My question is, what was God's status during that eternity before he created? If the definition of God is a creator, so what was he before he created? And they sort of, I don't know if it never occurred to them, if it was a new line of thinking, but they sort of looked at me funny. So first of all, let me tell you what I did not say to them. I'll tell you what I did not say. I did not tell them that somebody told me that philosophy is a bunch of questions that can never be answered and religion is a bunch of answers that can never be questioned. And that according to that definition, Judaism is neither. Because we answer our questions, we question our answers. Judaism is not a philosophy, it's not a religion. So what is it? Judaism is revelation. See, a religion is man's best attempt to answer the questions of life. Why am I here? And then the religious answer is God. So God is the answer to the question of why am I here? So, of course, if that's your starting point, your definition of God is going to be a creator. Because you don't even ask about God until there's a creation. If I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't even need a God concept. So all religions, by definition, God is creator because he's the answer to the question, why are we all here? Oh, because the creator created us, he put us here. Judaism is not a religion. Judaism is revelation. Judaism is God asking a question. Why am I here? And we are his answer. But I didn't tell them any of this. What I told them is that I thought it was interesting to say that God needs to be a creator. That's part of the definition of God, is that he's a creator, when, you know, creation didn't always exist. God always existed. And to sort of define God in terms of this project called creation seems rather egocentric. You know, it's basically like, well, you know, here I am, I'm a creation, so now I have to have a God concept. Who is God? Well, he's bigger than me, he's older than me, he's stronger than me. Ah, he's a creator. You know, maybe God has an identity that is so beyond creation that has, you know, nothing to do with you. Could it be possible that God has an identity that isn't defined vis-a-vis your existence? Like I said, religions don't have that concept because a religion only comes along once people exist. People exist, they have to understand why. They ask, why am I here? And the answer is God. Judaism is the opposite. It's revelation. God asking the question, why am I here? Ah, because of you, because of my relationship with you. At any rate, at this point in the panel, I had everyone sort of, well, you know, half confused, half frustrated. So I said, but hold on. None of this was really my real question. I told you I'm going to answer a question the authentically Jewish way with a question, but I have to admit, this question wasn't my real question. This was like the warm-up question. My real question is, since God is still God, even if he doesn't create, and in fact, God was God all the time before he began to create, the real question, the intelligent question that we're forced to ask is, since he didn't need to create, and he would still be God whether or not he ever created, and he was God long before he created, for an eternity, in fact, then the question becomes, so why did he create? He didn't need to do it. He wasn't compelled to do it. So why did he do it? I told them, this is the Jewish God concept. That the infinite one, who was not compelled to be a creator, who exists and has an identity well beyond being a creator, desired, yearned, longed to have a creation so that he could have a relationship with us. So that's what I told them. Does this Do you think that was a good representatively Jewish answer? I mean, in addition to the whole question and observation and second question, and but the actual teichen, the content. Yeah, I think so. I think it's pretty authentically Jewish. Absolutely new, radically new, unheard of. In fact, one of them got really excited. I won't say which religion it was, but he blurted out, "Beroiv Hispilus." He was so excited. And he said, "Rabbi, your God has a wonderful personality." I said, "Thank you. I like him too." Yeah, it was totally radical. They never heard such a concept. Again, I'm telling you, a religion is, I'm here, why am I here? Oh, because of God. So once you've answered the question, why I'm here, because of God, you're done exploring. But revelation is God saying, hey, you're my answer. You give me meaning. Now we're just beginning. We're just beginning the exploration of discovering each other, of the relationship. And you can say, well, what could God discover about us? He knows us. He made us. But he also gave us free will, and he gave us the power to break his heart. You know, when I say he yearned, he had passionate yearning, even perhaps you could even translate nisave, that he had a taiva, you could translate even he lusted. And when I say that he gives us free will so that we can break his heart, and I understand the romantic overtones, but this is not my innovation. You know, the wisest of all men was Shlomo Melech, was King Solomon. And when he had, the sages tell us he had 3,000 metaphors for every topic. But when he wanted to encapsulate the unique relationship between God and the Jewish people, he chose the format of an erotic love poem. In fact, this reminds me, one time I was speaking, I won't say where it was, but I mentioned this, that King Solomon, when he wanted to encapsulate the unique relationship between God and the Jewish people, he wrote an erotic love poem. And this lady looks at me like I fell off the moon. And so I said, yes, that's right. That was the metaphor that King Solomon chose, and I explained it again. She said, but why? I don't get it. Why? Why would he write an erotic love poem? And I explained it again. Well, you know, it's the lovers, and it's Ani L'Doidi, V'Doidi Li, and it's this passion and this. But why? Why would he write an erotic love poem? I said, because he wrote an erotic love poem. And we're going back and back and back and forth. And finally, I was, what are you saying? And she says, a neurotic love poem. She's saying a neurotic love poem. And I had been saying an erotic love poem. I said, yeah, you're right. That would be crazy if King Solomon wrote a neurotic love poem. I don't even know what would that be? Roses are red, violets are blue. You really need to get my mother's recipe for brisket. Right, Oedipus, Oedipus, as long as he loves his mother, right? Okay. When King Solomon wanted to convey our relationship, he used romance, he used passion. And in fact, you know, in the times of the sages, there was a debate about whether or not Shir HaShirim, whether Song of Songs, was part of the biblical canon. And it was Rabbi Akiva. It was Rabbi Akiva who told the other Chachamim, the other sages, he said that all of the Kisvei Kodesh, all of the books, Tzugzunt, all of the books of Tanakh are holy, are Kodesh, but Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, which is an erotic love poem, is Kodesh HaKadoshim, is the Holy of Holies. It's interesting that he described it as Holy of Holies, because Holy of Holies, we all know, is a place in the Beis HaMikdash. It's sort of the epicenter. The core, the inner sanctum. You start from the outside, and you enter the land of Israel, then you enter the walls of Yerushalayim, and then you get to the Temple Mount, and then you get to the courtyard, and then you get to the holy area, and then finally the Holy of Holies, and that's the inner sanctum. And it's sort of the same thing. You know, Hashem is one, but I'm finite, and I experience different contexts of the relationship at different times. So sometimes we experience Hashem as a judge, sometimes as a king, sometimes as a lawgiver, sometimes as the sustainer. And these are all true, but if you delve deeply, layer after layer, and you come to the core, the inner sanctum, the Kodesh Kodoshim, the center of our relationship is intimacy, is romance. Like the lovers that Solomon writes about in Song of Songs. And that's the essence of our relationship with God. And that's why Rabbi Akiva says, all the other holy books are holy, but Song of Songs is holy of holies, because it's the center, it's the core. When you delve deep and you get down to the essence of it, that's what the relationship is. It's a romance. And a romance is about vulnerability. And vulnerability is about getting hurt. See, contrary to popular misconception, vulnerability does not mean that by being open about my feelings, I decrease my chances of getting hurt. That's actually the opposite of vulnerability. That's like faux vulnerability. I'm going to trade some emotional transparency for some, you know, you have to, now you owe it to me. It would only be the decent thing to not make me feel foolish for having done that. And that's not vulnerability. That's emotional barter. Vulnerability doesn't mean that I'm going to be open about myself and thereby decrease my chances of getting hurt. Vulnerability means I'm going to be open about myself and increase my chances of getting hurt, and I'm going to do it anyway because that's the price for intimacy. Because we cannot... Someone once told me, intimacy is into me see. If I don't let you see into me, then there's no intimacy. So vulnerability means I'm going to let you know who I really am. Now, how do I let you know who I really am? How do I let you see into me? If I tell you what I want... When I tell you my desires, now you see into me. In fact, you see me. Vulnerability is when I let you know what I like and what I dislike. And I'm very careful about who I share that information with. Because once you know what I like, you can melt my heart, but which is dangerous in and of itself, but even more dangerous, once you know what I dislike, you can really hurt me. So I have to be careful who I tell this information to. When a Jew wants to lash out at Hashem, he knows exactly what sandwich to eat. He knows really how to hurt God. How does he know? Where did he find out? Where did the Jew find out? He figured it out. What? God told us. Well, why did he go and do a crazy thing like that? Why did he let us know how to hurt him? You know, before God gave the Torah, he had an offer for love without any risk of heartbreak. The offer was on the table. The angels, in fact, they when Moses went on high to receive the Torah during those 40 days, the angels, they argued that if the Jewish people would receive the Torah, they would ruin it. And that instead, the Torah, which is from heaven, should remain there and be given to the angels, who are also from heaven. And God told Moses, "No, you argue with them." And what did Moses argue? He said a few things. He said, you know, honor your parents. Do you guys have parents? I took you out of Egypt. Were you slaves in Egypt? Don't murder. Don't steal. Do you guys have temptations like that? But then the real coup de grace, where Moses sort of dropped the mic and walked off stage, so to speak, as he said, "Klum yetzahara yesh b'neichem. Do you guys even have an evil inclination?" And of course they had to admit, of course, no, we don't. And Moses said, fine, so then I rest my case. And God liked that. And then the argument was over. At that point, the argument was over. It was done. And then God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. Doesn't it seem funny? Doesn't it seem counterintuitive? The angels come and they say, God, don't give the Torah to the Jews. They're going to break your heart. And God says, Moses, you tell the angels. And Moses says to the angels, do you guys even have an evil inclination? That sounds like an argument in their behalf. God wasn't looking for perfection, God was looking for and is looking for a relationship. And a relationship means I risk being hurt. Now, how can the all-powerful put himself in a position of being hurt? By revealing his desires to imperfect people who have been given free will and the ability to say no. No, I'm not going to do what you like. No, I'm going to do this anyway. I like it. I don't care that you don't like it. I'm sorry. Angels would never do that. Angels would never think of that. But that's not what God was after. That's not what he was looking for. So I say, you know, when a Jew wants to lash out at God, he knows exactly what sandwich to eat. Why? Because God told us. Why did God tell us? So that we could have an intimate relationship. There's actually a story like this. It's not even a joke. It's a real story. Rabbi Steinsaltz in Eretz Yisrael was giving a Gemara shir for professors at the Hebrew University. And there was this particular fellow, he was trying to invite him to come to the class. And this guy said, no, I'm not going to come to the class. Ani chiloni, I'm secular. Rabbi Steinsaltz said that we have a number of secular professors who come to the class. It's really not a problem. And he told him, Ata lo mivin, you don't understand. At kedekach, to the extent to which I am secular. Ani ochel basi chazir, I eat pork. B'Shabbat, dafka, on the Sabbath, exclusively. So Rabbi Steinsaltz says, okay, so I have my way of observing the Shabbos, you have your way of observing the Shabbos. But there's a point there. There's no Gentile in the world who is, you know, on a Wednesday afternoon at his favorite restaurant, he's about to bite into a pork sandwich, and he says, stop, waiter, wrap this up. I'm going to take this home and whip it out on Friday night and make a statement. God made himself vulnerable. He told us what he likes and what he dislikes. Jewish men, if you take the verses of Shema and you put them on parchment and put them in leather boxes and put them on your heart and on your head, to me, that's like a dozen roses and a box of chocolates. I love it. Warms my heart. If you take wool and linen and you mix them to a single fiber, don't do that. It's like nails on a chalkboard. I hate it. Can't stand it. Pet peeve. And You can't say to somebody, well, why? Why don't you like it? Well, what's wrong with it? Why does it bother you? Because it bothers me, I'm telling you. That's why telling somebody your likes and dislikes is so intimate. It's counterintuitive, but what's stronger, what's more powerful, a want or a need? I see I already tipped you off and I told you it was counterintuitive, but we think needs are more powerful than wants. You have to get what you need. Yeah, that's true, but on the other hand, needs are rather predictable. Needs are rather universal. For the most part, everyone has the same needs. Wants, on the other hand, can get kind of weird. You know, your quirks, your idiosyncrasies. And I wouldn't guess what you like or dislike. I could guess what you need. Like, would you please stop waking me up? I need to sleep. I mean, that's... And when you reveal to me that you need sleep, that's not there's no intimacy there. That's not bonding. That's not personal information. But if you tell me, oh, you got me Jelly Bellies and you picked out all the licorice ones, that's so sweet. Well, you're not going to die if I don't pick out the licorice Jelly Bellies. But the fact now I have that information about something you don't need, but something you desire, that's a bridge. That's intimacy. That's into me see. I'll put it a different way. Needs are rational, and therefore needs can be defended. You can argue on behalf of your needs. So let's say a husband and wife get into an argument. The husband says, we need a second car. And she says, we don't need a second car. And they argue it out. No, we do. No, we don't. Okay, explain, defend it, argue it. And then in the end, if somebody still doesn't agree with you, basically, what are they telling you? They're saying your arguments were not strong enough. You think we need it, you're wrong, we don't need it, or you think you don't need it, you're wrong, you do need it. But basically, what am I doing if I argue about a need? Because needs are rational. Therefore, if I argue against your need, basically, it's an intellectual argument. I'm just telling you, you're not as smart as you thought you were. You thought you needed it. I disagree. I think you don't need it. So you're just rejecting the person's intellect. But let's say somebody expresses a desire. Let's say they say, you know, I really want to paint this room green. And they say, yeah, prove it to me. Argue on behalf of that desire. Give me a logical proof that that's what you want. I can't. Oh, so you admit it's illogical. No, it's not illogical. It's not measured by logic. See, ideas are measured by logic. So some are more logical, some are less logical, some are illogical. But desires are not measured on a scale of logic or illogic. A desire is just a whole different ball game. So first of all, I cannot argue on the behalf of my desire, and the fact that I can't argue and defend it doesn't mean I don't want it. To the contrary, actually, the desires that are the most intense are the ones that I have the least intelligent argument for. The more intellect that's mixed into it, the less intense of a desire it is. Okay, that's first of all. But second of all, let's say I tell you my desire. You know, I just really want to paint this room green. And then someone says, well, that's a stupid thing to want. Okay, no problem. I will never tell you anything personal about myself ever again. See, if I told you a need and you fought with me and argued and said, no, you don't need it. Okay, you're just rejecting my intellect because needs are rational and they can be defended with intellect. But if I express a desire, a want, and you say, ah, that's not a thing to want, you're not rejecting my intellect, you're rejecting me. My desire is me. My desire, so my intellect is just my mind, but my desire is me. When I tell you I think, that's my intellect thinking. When I say I want, that's me. I want it. Why do I want it? Because that's what I want. And therefore, if you validate my desire, not my need, you cannot be intimate just by validating needs. I mean, it's a little bit of a prerequisite to an intimate relationship to acknowledge needs, but that's not the intimacy. The intimacy is, if I tell you what I desire, if I tell you my secret likes and dislikes, and you invalidate it, you've rejected me. And conversely, if I reveal to you my secret likes and dislikes, and you affirm my desire, you have affirmed me. In other words, when I say, I like this, and you say, got it, say no more. But you want to hear my reason? Don't need a reason. Good enough. You like it, you got it. What are you telling me? And doesn't that feel so good? What you're telling me is, it matters because I matter. And then the opposite would be, when you tell me my desires don't matter, well, apparently I don't matter, because if I mattered, then my desires would matter to you. I was once teaching the Rebbe's first discourse, Bossi Lagani, which is based on a verse in Song of Songs. And I don't remember exactly how it occurred, but there was a woman in this class who said, I remember distinctly the word she used. She said, you make God sound like a wimp. And I said, why? Why am I making God sound like a wimp? You know, all romantic and mushy and like, he desires us. He wants an intimate relationship. There's a general rule, don't answer the question, answer the questioner. You have to know who you're talking to. So I didn't know a lot about this woman. She was not a regular at the class. But one thing that I did know about her was that she was a very, very successful corporate attorney. And she made a lot of money. In fact, her husband was also a lawyer, and she made a lot more money than he did. Not that that's the only barometer for success, but it's definitely a barometer. At any rate, my point is I knew that this was a very competent and very confident woman. So that was important for me to know before I began my line of questioning. So I said to her, okay, put aside this whole theological discussion for a second. Do you mind if I ask you a personal question? She says, go ahead. I said, all right, please don't filter. Don't answer from here. Answer from here. Just try to say the truth as you feel it, and don't censor yourself. Would you like to get flowers on your birthday this year from your husband? And to her credit, she was honest, and she said, yes, yes, of course, sure, sure I would. I said, okay, thank you. Thank you for acknowledging that. All right, now, let me ask you something. Your husband may or may not get you flowers this year on your birthday. There's a saying, if you want something done right, do it yourself. So here's what I propose. You call the florist. You order the bouquet that you most like. You can even write the card. If there's a particular love poem that you really like, you tell them, they'll put it on the card. They can do that. You could choose where to surprise yourself, where to deliver the flowers. On your doorstep, in your car, on your desk at work. Whatever you choose, you sweep yourself off your feet. And I guarantee you, you will do this well, because I know a little bit about what you do all day, And if I were to make a list of the things that you take care of on a daily basis, this would not even make the top 100 list in difficulty. You do things that are much, much harder than this every day. So, yes, I think you could take care of this marvelously. And she says, that doesn't work, and you know it. So I said, yes, you're right. Of course it doesn't work, and of course I know it. I know it, and you know it, but my question is, do we know why? Why doesn't it work? We know it doesn't work, but why? What are the mechanics of why it doesn't work? So I told her, because it's not about the flowers. If you needed flowers, I promise you something. As competent as you are, you would have flowers on your desk in a minute flat if you needed them. You would take care of it, or get someone to take care of it, or pay somebody. Because the thing about needs are, you can pay a stranger to meet your needs. Chick-chock, you just take care of it. But you don't need the flowers. You want them. And in fact, it's not even the flowers you want. It's flowers from your husband that you want. Does that make you a wimp? I want to tell you something. You know, thank God I get around, I tour, go to different cities, different states. There's a whole country in between New York and L.A. There's a whole country. Sometimes you go to the Bible Belt, you know, like Texas, I promise you there are a million Gentiles in America who will put on tefillin right now. No questions asked. And yet, Hashem is desperately waiting for that lost Jew walking down La Brea who hasn't put on tefillin in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. God, if you need the tefillin, I know plenty of Baptists who will do it. It's not the tefillin. I want my husband to send me flowers. It's about the relationship. It's about who it's from. And the one who I want it from is the one who can break my heart and who can make me feel like $1 million as well. That's intimacy. That's a relationship. God could not have that with the angels. The angels can't do that. They cannot do that for him. And that's why, when did God become king? Not when he became creator. He started creating on day one, but he didn't become king until day six. And not just on day six, but later in the afternoon when he had Adam, who had free will and could choose a relationship with him. And then every year on his anniversary, God's anniversary, the anniversary of the sixth day of creation, when God first was in a two-way street relationship where he could say, I like you, do you like me back? The anniversary of that day, every year, that's Rosh Hashanah. The sixth day of creation is Rosh Hashanah. It's the anniversary of the beginning of the relationship, a real relationship, a two-way street, vulnerability, intimacy. That's when it began. It began on day six of creation. And every year, God revisits the motives that brought him to that day. It's sort of like, you know, Chassidus says that on Erev Rosh Hashanah, on the eve of the new year, that the world is bisalfus. It's in a state of faint. The energy is gone. What does it mean, the energy of the world is gone? And why don't you feel it? And why don't people see it? Why doesn't the sky get dim? Why don't colors start to turn gray, you know? It's almost like sometimes you're on the phone with somebody. I don't know if this ever happens to you. And, you know, you got like 3% battery and it's an important... By the way, it's funny because I have 1% battery right now. Okay. And I just looked. It's a real... It's not a prop. It's a real phone. I know it's L.A., but it's not a prop. It's not from the props department. Real phone. So lifelike. Look at this. Okay. So you're on the phone, you're in the car, and you get this important call. Somebody you wanted to call, who you've been wanting to call you for a while. Hello, how are you? And you have to act all calm, businesslike, because you don't want to admit that you're this Michigan driving around in the car with 1% battery and no charger. So, yes, everything's very good. Yes, okay. And meanwhile, you're like, oh, no, where's the charger? Where's the charger? Okay, I got one in my house, one in my office. Which location is closer? Okay, all right, I can't use Waze. That'll use up battery, okay. And you turn around, and you start driving. I know exactly where it is. It's by the kitchen counter. It's right there. And it's down, it's like blinking. And yes, yes, and you're acting all calm. They don't know they're talking to a person whose call is about to drop, right? The whole thing is seamless. And you get out of the car, maybe even leave the car running. No, in L.A., don't leave the car running. Okay, and you take your, well, depends where. And you run inside, and you close the door behind you, and you plug the phone in. Yeah, and you continue talking calmly like nothing ever happened. And they don't know the whole drama that call almost dropped. But you plugged it in. It was at 0.00001%. Every year on Rosh Hashanah, the world is at like 0.00001% battery. And the world doesn't know. They're none the wiser. They have no clue. They're talking to a guy whose call is about to drop. And when the Jewish people sound the shofar in their shuls, it's like all of a sudden, the very last second, you just plug that baby right into the charger, and everything's back to normal, as if we weren't on the brink of total non-existence, which we were. A second ago, we were on the brink of it all being gone. Why does it work that way? So maybe you can look at it like this. Imagine a guy gets engaged, and he and his wife, or wife-to-be, his fiance, they plan a wedding. They have a wedding planned, an elaborate wedding at a nice hall, and with the caterers and the florists and the ice sculptures in the parking lot and the chopped liver mold in the shape of a swan. It's a nice event. And a band and everything. Okay. Now, the morning of the wedding, he gets a WhatsApp from his fiance. I'm not going to be able to make it. Okay, all right. No wedding. All right. So now he's got to figure out what he's going to do. All right. Well, he's brokenhearted. Yes, he's brokenhearted. But on the other hand, you know, the deposit on the hole, it's irrefundable. You can't get that back. The food's already made. It's coming over in the warmer trucks right now. The band's already doing a sound check. You know, forget it. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a really nice party. I'll just have, you know, a couple thousand of my closest friends, and we're going to have a party. So it won't be a wedding. It'll be a different kind of party. And obviously, no person in their right mind is going to go through with that. No one's going to do that. Because nobody wanted to have a party. Party was a celebration of something that's not happening anymore. And if that thing's not happening, then there's no reason for a party. So think about it like this, that God wants an intimate relationship with you. And in order to have that, you have to have free choice, and you have to be challenged. You have to be really challenged. You have to be tempted and distracted. Have to overcome the misuse of free choice and choose him for an intimate relationship by validating his likes and his dislikes, his 365 dislikes and his 248 likes. And in order for that to happen, God has to put you in a world with a body, and he has to make stuff, and he has to make scenery, and he has to have... This whole thing, this whole universe is just one elaborate forum within which for him to have an intimate relationship with you. That's the only reason he wants any of it. If you ask God, hey God, do you need a creation? He says, no, I don't need a creation. No, that's those other religions. They say I'm a creator. I don't need to be a creator. I'm still God if I don't create. I've been God for an eternity before I created. No, I don't need to create. So God, why? Why are you creating? Oh, because I really want to have, I want to be in an intimate relationship. Well, the angels, they're available. No, it's not the angels. The Jews in bodies with a Yetzer Hara and with a very distracting, confusing world. That's where I want it to happen. Come on, God, they're going to break your heart. I know, but it's going to be a heck of a romance, and it's going to end good. It's going to end real good. And I'm going to go for it. A fataiva frekmin nishkin kashis. You can't ask someone why they want what they want. You can ask for an intellectual and rational defense for why they need what they need, but God doesn't need anything. So to ask why, okay, fine, forget it. He needs nothing. He wants us, which is a million times, which is infinitely more powerful than a need. Needs are practical. Needs are business. You hire strangers to fulfill your needs. Desires are intimate. I think that's part of the misunderstanding, is that people who go into Rosh Hashanah afraid of the judgment, they often imagine it like a business relationship, as if God is running a business and he hired us as workers. And you know how workers are evaluated based on their performance. And you let it slide for a while, but eventually if a worker doesn't produce, so one day he goes to pick up his paycheck and there's the proverbial pink slip and it says, thank you very much for your time with the firm. We wish you best of luck at your further endeavors. And people feel they're going to go into Rosh Hashanah, God's going to look at them, going to look at their year, and basically say, I'm sorry, you're not cutting it anymore. We can't keep you around. We're going to let you go. Good luck. You can't work here anymore. And if it were practical, and if creation were a logical endeavor, then it makes sense. You review people, and then if they're not performing, you cut them. But creation isn't logical. It's not logical. It's not illogical either. It's desire, and desire is not judged based on logic or illogic. Desire is a whole different world than need. Desire is romance, is passion. And you can't tell someone, well, your passion is illogical. That's right. It's a desire. It's not logical or illogical. That's not the scale on which it is measured. When people say about romance, this is so stupid, I hate this. I don't need this. You know what? They're right. They don't need it. You don't need romance. So why do people want it so much? Because God implanted his desire into us. That's his signature in our psyche. He made us desire intimacy as a way of making us godlike. He made us have his story. What's his story? The story of human beings, where we came from and where gender comes from. Male and female and desire. An intimate union. When God created Adam, Adam wasn't male or female. Adam is a human being. And then God said to the Adam, it's not good for the Adam to be alone. which was, by the way, the first instance of the splitting of the atom. You like that? Okay. All right. And God separated Adam. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. And God separated Adam into halves. Now, how do you separate something into halves? Sometimes you could do left and right. Sometimes you could do top and bottom, front and back. In this case, he did male and female, masculine and feminine. Those are the two halves of a complete human being. A complete human being is both masculine and feminine, but he split them up. So he had a masculine half, he had a feminine half. And then once he had two halves, what did he do? He said, now cleave together and become one flesh. You know what that's called in Jewish? A dreikup. You had one, and now you want two. You have two, now get together, become one. Make up your mind. God implanted in our psyche his story. Because that's his story. God is one. Alone. And he said, this is not a good way to be. I don't want to be one and alone. So God divided himself, so to speak, as it were. You know, sometimes I ask non-Jewish groups when I speak to non-Jews, I say, is God creator or creation? And they all fall for it. They jump on it. Creator. And I say, so then what does it mean here? O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. If you say he's creator to the exclusion of creation, then what happened to one? One means creator and creation are both aspects, both manifestations of the one. So God divided himself, so to speak, into halves, creator and creation, let's call it, or infinite and finite, or spiritual and physical, or perfect and imperfect, however you want to look at it. And then what did he say? Now cleave together and become one. But God, that's what you had before you created anything. You had one. No, I was alone. I didn't have one. One is the pleasure, the profound pleasure of reunion over union. So don't ask a person why we want this, why we desire this. We desire it because God desires it. And why does God desire it? Because that's what he desires. And if you say, well, that's rather trivial. I mean, it's just a desire. Okay, I suppose there are people who are like that, who are so business-like that they think of God as this efficient machine. And I suppose that's why, you know, in keeping with that, you might go into the new year and thinking that you will be reviewed as being inefficient and you will be fired like an unproductive employee. Or you could understand that the whole thing of creation doesn't make sense. It's not logical. He didn't need to do it. He deeply desired it and desires it. And therefore, the whole thing's a romance. It's about a relationship. And therefore, even if he will look at your year and find you lacking, when lovers find each other drifting, they don't write each other off. They desire each other even more, which is why don't do this because it's not nice and don't play hard to get on purpose. But God wants our tshuva more than our mitzvahs. I said it's not nice. Don't purposely do that to him. That wouldn't be decent. It wouldn't be compassionate. But it's true. He wants our tshuva more than our mitzvahs. Which is why when the relationship is on the rocks, he chases us even more. He desires us even more. Because it's not business. It's not, sorry, you're unproductive. Here's your pink slip. Good luck. It's, I want you so much. I made all of this for you. I made all of this in order that we could have our romance. And I already made my move. I already told you I want you. Now I'm waiting. What's your answer? Do you want me? He acts first. He makes the overture. He's vulnerable. He told us at Sinai. And he tells us every moment by recreating. I want you. Do you want me? But then once a year, he says, hold on a second. Hold on a second. This is all here for one reason. This universe, I don't need a universe. I don't need planets and moons and quasars.
What do I need this? I made the universe as a forum within which to have a romance. Again, it's like that guy who, he didn't make a wedding party to have a party. He made a wedding party to celebrate the marriage. But if there's no marriage, there's no party. So God checks back in with us. And he says, listen, I want you. Do you still want me? And at that moment, on Rosh Hashanah, when the world is down to 0.00001% battery, because he's lost that desire, he's lost the motive to have a world, because, you know, he's questioning whether or not it's all worth it, and he turns to the Jewish people and he says, are you still in this? And we say, yeah, we want you. He says, oh, wow. If that's the case, you just gave me the power to create all of this again for another year. It's all here only as a place within which we can have our relationship. No relationship, none of it matters. The guy who was stood up at the altar is not going to the wedding hall to dance or to eat from the food or to use the valet parking. He has no interest in it whatsoever. Without his relationship with the Jewish people, God has no interest in having a world. It's not something he normally does. And he would just go right back to being whatever he was for eternity. So I think we have to understand, first of all, our power, our tremendous power on Rosh Hashanah, when God is essentially just waiting for our answer. And the answer only has two possible variations. It's not a particularly, it's not an essay test. It's multiple choice, and there's two choices. It's like the guy who was on El Al, and the Israeli stewardess told him it's time for dinner. He said, what are the choices? She says, you eat or you don't. Rosh Hashanah is a very simple day. Are you in or are you out? A lot of times couples come for counseling and they want to basically explain why their marriage isn't working, which is not a great idea, because basically you're giving them the opportunity to become more articulate about why they hate each other. I found it much, much, much more productive to not do that. And the way I think to explain it very logically is like this. Let's first establish one thing. Are we keeping this marriage together or are we ending it? Because if we're keeping it together, airing dirty laundry is not conducive to that. And if we're ending it, let's end it amicably. And airing dirty laundry is not conducive to that. So let's first decide, is this marriage continuing? And usually the reaction is, well, that's what we're here to figure out. But see, that it doesn't work that way. It won't work that way. You can't say, I'm not sure whether I'm in it, but let's talk about all the horrible things we've done to each other and then decide. That's like a really bad way to come to that conclusion. First, tell me, do we want this to work? No one's forcing you. Do you want it to work or not? If you don't, okay, so let's figure out how to take it apart. But first answer, do you want it to work or not? And if both parties say yes, I don't know how, I don't see a future, but yeah, I want it to work. Okay. Now, let's carefully start to discuss some of the things that have gone wrong and how to make sure that they don't happen anymore. That's basically Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah is not a time for confession. We have 10 days of penitence, Aseres Yemei Teshuva, to work on our issues. But Rosh Hashanah is the first counseling session where there's only one question. Are you in or are you out? Are you committed? Do we want this to work? Well, I don't see how it could work. There's so many issues. Okay, but can we pause with the issues? We have 10 days, and we're going to work up to it. We're going to work through the issues. But before we touch the issues, can we get a commitment? Yes or no? In or out? That's Rosh Hashanah. And then if you say, yeah, I'm here. I want this. Then we work it out. Okay, then there's tshuva. We'll figure out how to fix it. And then by the time it's Sukkot and Simchas Torah, we're already dancing.
So the point is like this. It's, Sunday night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Well, we got 3 days now. So we have 3 days to think about our answer to this question. It's almost too much time. It would almost be a relief if Rosh Hashanah were right now. We have 3 days to be ready to answer one question. Our beloved, our lover, the one who made universes as a place within which to have a relationship with us, has told us already, I want this to work. I'm in it for another year. I'm here. I know you have issues, and I have issues, and we'll talk about it. We'll work through it. But I want to know, do you still want me? And if the answer is yes, then I will create all of this again for another year. When you go into a Rosh Hashanah with that mindset, it's incredibly uplifting and empowering. It's also incredibly humbling at the same time. He wants me. He wants me. He's doing all this for me. All right, I'll give him a shot. Let's make this work again. It's such a good love story. It's such a wonderful, it's the best love story. It's not a business. You're not employees. You're not being graded on your efficiency. Ugh. It's a love story. It's an anniversary. It's the anniversary of the first time that Adam said, yes, I want you. It's a renewal of vows. And really, it's a preparation. As Hasidim know, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is really just the ceremony to prepare us for the real celebration of Sukkot and Simchas Torah and the dancing at the wedding, which is the celebration of the marriage of Hashem and the Jewish people. And really, it should be even bigger than that. It should be the biggest celebration of all. We should celebrate the complete revelation before all humanity, the entire world, all 7 billion people should see the intimate romantic relationship of the Jewish people and God fully revealed, which will be with the coming of Mashiach.